You are listening to the Venture Scale SaaS Operator, the podcast where we interview founders who are actually in the trenches. We talk about the transparent journey of how they built their SaaS companies, how they grow them, and what they would do differently if they would do it all over. Hey folks, with us today, Ernest, the founder of PredictNow.ai. Ernest, super happy to have you on.
Thanks for inviting me, Nicholas. I'm very excited to chat about our experience.
Awesome. Let's start with the most important thing. What is PredictNow.ai and who is it for?
PredictNow.ai is a machine learning / AI company targeting the asset management sector. I have been an asset manager for many years, starting on Wall Street and moving on to private wealth management from our hedge fund. And at the same time, I have been a machine learning researcher, ever since I started working postgraduate school. So these two themes have been constant in my career, and PredictNow really is the crystallization of these two passions of mine. We intend to use machine learning to help asset managers do better. Obviously different managers have different level of skills, but no matter what your skill level, we hope to 3x what it is. We don't want to say 10x because we're not delusional. But we at least want to 3x what they have been able to achieve on their own without the help of machine learning.
And then for the ones who aren't deeply knowledgeable about the financial sector, asset manager, do you think more of like a BlackRock that owns a bunch of stuff from real estate to financial assets, or is it more like a venture capital firm? Like, who's the type of asset manager that you're working with?
Yes. So, we typically target asset managers who manage publicly traded assets. So, real estate or private equity investment would be less of our focus, simply because there's not enough high-frequency data. So machine learning, as many would know, takes a lot of data to make it work. And if you have, private equity deals, the data could be spotty and could be sparse. And, real estate data, you don't have transaction more than once every few years. That would not be ideal use case for our service. So publicly traded equity, certainly futures, options, anything that, you can get at least daily frequency data, would be our objective, would be our use case.
Understood. And then you're based in Canada. So are you Canada specific? Do you target the US because it's a major market? Or how do you see internationalization as a non-US company?
So most of our clients are in the US. There are some in Europe. I don't know that there are any current clients are in Asia, but yeah, it's a US-centric service with some European clients. But of course, the European clients oftentimes use our technology to trade in the US markets as well.
So are you then only or mostly tracking US assets, meaning the stocks and so on? Or like take us a bit deeper into that, because I think it's always super interesting because most of the media that is produced is like very US centric, but I feel like not a lot of people show how it's like to not be in the US and maybe still working with US customers with US data and so on.
Yes. So there are two parts of a machine learning service like ours, a machine learning SaaS service. The first part is data, input data. And the second part is the algorithm, the machine learning algorithm. So obviously, the algorithm itself is neutral to any market or of any country. You can use it on any country's asset. It's the same software, same conceptual framework. But we need data to train any model. And the client provide data, yes, it's true that we need some client data, but that's very simple. Basically, we need the data from the client is the daily returns of their of the components of their portfolio. Like if they have a stock portfolio, what are the returns of the stock in the portfolio? And this stock can be European, Asian, whatever stock, no problem. So the client, if this data is provided by client, obviously it also doesn't have any geographical restriction. But there's another part of the data that we provide, we call them pre-engineered features. And this would be data that are global macroeconomic data. It would be equity-driven data, futures-driven data. And except for some of the Forex, foreign exchange data, most of these data are procured from the US market. Like, for example, when you say macroeconomic data, well, we have data from the U.S. Federal Reserve. We don't have data from European Central Bank. And that is our current state. So, as a startup, we cannot afford to buy data across the world. We can only afford to buy data in the U.S. And that's why it is currently U.S.-centric. It doesn't mean that there's a fundamental limitation to the technology. As long as there's more money, we can always buy data from other countries. But we don't yet get to that stage. And besides, our main clients are all in the US, so they're happy with what our current data set provide.
Makes a ton of sense. I would love to double click on that because I think there are like a lot of AI startups starting right now. And as you said, of course, like every algorithm is only good as good as the data you feed it. So I think it's a two-part question. One, like very technical. So do you buy from like quote unquote third parties like Bloomberg, or like where do you buy your data? Like what's like the data source, maybe on like a more meta level? And the other is, how do you think of investing capital in buying data? Maybe even when fundraising, you need to plan out what you're spending the money on. So take us through that, because I think especially for like the people who are starting AI companies and maybe don't come from a financial background, that's something they might miss out on.
Indeed. So data can be very expensive. And depending on the frequency of data, it could be like you sometimes need a five-digit budget monthly. But that's why we restrict our data frequency to daily, which typically are much cheaper. Much cheaper is, again, relative to the five-digit monthly budget. So... also very fortunate that because I've been in the industry for a long time and I have developed many relationships with data vendors over time, we have been able to form strategic partnership. Some of these data vendors, such as AlgoSeq, they have taken an equity stake in our company and started a strategic partnership. So they basically provide data to us, cash free. Others such as Schrader, I've been buying their data for years upon years. And so again, they are able to sign a license agreement with us that are very cost effective to us. We are able to procure data from many sources that at the same time, high quality, and yet very economical. And that is really one of our competitive advantage, is that because of the decades of domain expertise, we know how to get this started without a huge budget. Expensive data does not necessarily mean good as well. So we have also bought data at a significant, not five-digit, four-digit monthly cost. And we find that the data were not satisfactory at all. And we were instead nowadays able to get a free alternative that is better. So yeah, the data engineering part is actually quite half of the business. How to procure data that is high quality and affordable. That is as important as algorithmic advances in machine learning. And many machine learning founders may not care about this because a lot of machine learning firms are using data such as what you can scrape from the web, but that won't do from asset management.
If you need to hire the right developers and ship fast, then React Squad is for you. A boutique agency that specializes in React and only works with fast growth startups. Visit reactsquad.io to learn more.
And then let's talk about building the company itself. Like, tell us everything. Like, how much did you raise? How big is the team? Give us an overview of the company right now.
Yes. So we really, when we first started, we really adopted the lean startup philosophy, which is to spend and raise as little as possible and get the product out and trying to get some traction and find a perfect market fit before we go out and raise a lot of money. So today we raise around 1 million and we have, I believe, found the perfect market cap with this 1 million. So, you know, pretty, not the world's record in lean startup for, by any means, but, you know, still is, you know, okay in my subjective opinion. So the, and you know, of course we made many mistakes. We actually, if I were to do it over again, we could have done it with less than half of that 1 million. But hey, you know, you...
As always.
So, yeah. So, so we use that 1 million to develop a product, but more importantly to, you know, to find what segment of the market is the best fit for us. And we spent a lot of the money because we thought that a different segment is what we should target. So we spent a lot of money building technology, particularly user interface, for the segment of market that really is not the best fit. If we do it again and we somehow had, you know, this prophetic vision and know exactly which market we should be targeting, the whole thing definitely can be done, you know, maybe one third, because we would probably not even have a user interface.
let's maybe double click on that. Can you walk us through that story? Because I think especially for early stage founders, and you're not early anymore, you're 4 years in, but like, who were like the two ICPs you thought of? And then how did you make the decision of that's the one to go after and this one we can cut out?
Yes. So, you know, like a lot of startup, you know, when you first started, you thought, well, you know, obviously we should target someone that have a lower... You know, the early adopters, you know, that would have lower expectation of the perfection of a product, right? So you roll out something, you know, half baked, and you know, obviously you can't go to Goldman, try to sell this to Goldman Sachs, right? If it's some new product that is half baked, put together with $150,000 of investment, you don't expect Goldman Sachs to buy it. So we say, okay, let's start with the retail investment community. And there's some traction, you know, maybe you get 20 subscribers, but they don't pay the bill because they can't afford.
Quick question. Retail meaning a regular human being, a citizen, me basically buying my stock, having like a small, like maybe tens of thousands of dollars in the stock portfolio and wanting to optimize that.
Right, right. Actually, retail traders, I should not say investor, but because, you know, let's say someone who is a retiree, that would not be our target.
Yeah.
So it would be a active trader, but still trading a small account, let's say, you know, up to $100,000, you know, that kind of trade. They are very serious. They may be very tech savvy. But they don't have a lot of capital to trade. They're not like making a living solely perhaps based on this. So it's like active but still retail trader. Like I said, we signed up about 20 of them, but the success rate and the customer retention was not great because we find that this service requires a lot of help, a lot of support, and a lot of data. We can't afford to give them the data if they're paying like $50 a month. So we target the next level up, the small hedge funds that manage under 100 million. And we get a few customers that are able to pay us 4-digit a month, even with that tier. But again, even with that tier, a lot of times their focus is survival.
And quick question, how many employees would such a hedge fund be? Would it be like 5 to 15 or like how many people would work?
For a hedge fund that managed about 100 million, it's rare to find more than three employees.
Interesting.
Rare.
Yeah.
Rare. It's a mom and pop. You can think of it as a mom and pop shop. You know, people think, oh, hedge fund, George Soros, whatever, Bill Ackman, fancy swanky office on top of Manhattan. No, most hedge funds that are at 100 million operate in the basement with three guys or three girls. So,
all right. Yeah. So so retail, basically like prosumer, super SMB, and then?
Yeah. Well, so we get a bit more revenue from that segment, but again, we see that, you know, it still is a struggle to really scale it. You know, you need, four digits sounds good if you could find, you know, 10 of these customers, but we struggle to maintain a portfolio of 10 of these customers every month because some of them will quit because of the lack of support. Although now at that tier, we provide them with data, so success is easier, but still we don't have a lot of time to help them. And oftentimes their data science and machine learning expertise is not sufficient really to maximize. You really need a full-time quant. So some of these clients, even though they're managing maybe 10 million, 20 million, they have a part-time quant that work on it, and that was not a very successful setup. You really need someone full-time that does nothing but make this a success. And to do that, you need more than 100 million AUM. And then one day, so we started to, so okay, what about we go up another level to the large funds, 1 billion and up? And there are some interests. I personally reach out to maybe 100 of these funds because a lot of people read my books. So they already know when I email them. I mean, when I reach out to them by LinkedIn, we are already connected. They say, hey, Ernie Chen, I read your book when I was in school or when bought whatever. What's up? And then we can have a discussion. But there are some people who sign up. But interestingly, the biggest customer that sign up with us is an inbound email. And that's very interesting because I learned that same experience happened with one of our investors. Our investor is a technology entrepreneur as well. He is very successful. He exited his first startup already. And he told me that the pivotal point in their company journey is that it's again because of a inbound email from one of the largest UK bank. That was what changed their trajectory. And for us, it's one of the top US bank suddenly sent me an email. They say, I do a Google search and you know, it seems that what you're doing might be a good fit to us. It's a Google search. Okay,
great. That's so crazy.
And then we started a POC last year, and now the POC is a success. And now we're talking to some senior people in the bank to market a fund-driven biotechnology. I say, wow, all this from an inbound email. And then now, because of that, we are able to leverage that success and go after other major banks in the US. And so hopefully that will be really the change, the pivot to this new sector. It's so far been a success. So that's how it was the journey in terms of finding product market fit.
So right now, after you got that maybe not lucky, but at least like a very appreciative inbound email, did you do anything to double down on inbound? I mean, like, first of all, like, how did they find you on Google? I guess you had like some content out there. It's like on the very tactical part, like, what are you now doing with that insight that, hey, amazing opportunities can come inbound?
Yes. Well, I have actually, you might call it public relation, right? I mean, the whole point of public relation is to generate this kind of inbound email as opposed to active outreach marketing, outbound marketing. And public relation is something I've been doing for 25 years. So ever since I quit my last job, which was 2006, I quit my job at the end of 2005, and after that, I've never worked for anybody. And starting from that point, I already know that as an independent business person, I need to use PR to help because I obviously cannot buy a Super Bowl ad and front page Wall Street Journal. That's out of my reach. PR is what I do. So I started in 2006 by blogging And then by blog attracted the attention of a lot of major media outlets. So CNBC asked to interview me just because of blog posts. I said, wow. And then, you know, New York Times interviewed me, Wall Street Journal reporter asked me for opinion, Bloomberg interviewed me. So I basically have contacts in all the major financial media, and I continue to write blog. And then Wiley Publishing wanted me to write books on the strength of my blog. So I published many books. So because of those books, many of the asset managers read me when they was in college. So, well, I, you know, you can tell how advanced in age I am, because if
the ones listening, a tiny bit of gray hair here.
So yeah, so when you know, an example, the head of AI at Fidelity, I met her in a conference and say, hey Ernie, one of the reasons I switched to finance from a physics background is because when I was in Harvard, I read your books. And so, you know, a lot of people told me that. And so my PR has been a constant theme for 20 years. And with Predict Now, when we got started, we have been very diligent in writing blog posts and also even peer review papers and white papers. So if people go to our website, there's so much material, YouTube, free webinar, paid webinars, you know, all kinds of media. We have content, and these are not marketing content. They are significant, sort of substantial content about how to apply machine learning finance. So, that's why people, you know. So, as an example, when people go to ChatGPT and say who is the best algorithmic trading author, typically my books will come up at the top. So it's very easy for people to find me. So it's no coincidence that this bank, and by the way, Citibank, when the manager just Google who is doing machine learning in finance, and they, you know, typically our company or my name will come up at top. So it's because of this decades of effort in building the content out there. It's not an overnight flash in the pan endeavor.
I think that's amazing, because I think a lot of marketers nowadays would, I think like 10 years ago, they would have said like it's inbound marketing, and now they would say it's marketing like a media company and like building a personal brand. But I read a book a while ago about how McKinsey was built, and even they, when it was like now, like 70 years ago, basically wrote books and so on. So I think it's like just providing value, like truly value without having a sale behind that immediately, I think it's just a tried and true thing in human nature. So I love that you put in the work for like 25 years in that, and then a lucky email came from a bank.
Yeah, exactly. Lucky, yes. You need to set the table for this luck to happen. Otherwise, the luck won't happen.
Yeah. I love that. And then how big is the company right now? Like how many employees? What's the revenue?
So right now we are actually merging with another startup, because what we do is really, I feel, much more of a technology and deep tech research. And then this other company, which I also co-founded with another co-founder, they are much more product driven and sales driven. And you know, my skill is really in research, and my co-founder skills is much more in business development. So I thought it's a good match. So we're in the process of merging. So, you know, we don't yet have significant revenue, because the proof of concept, although it's a success, the bank has just started to market the fund. We expect to reach 7-digit ARR by the end of this year or early next year, once the fund is formed. And in terms of the team, we have about 10 members in the combined company. So a lot of them are quite senior technologists or investment professionals from well-known firms. So another superpower of my co-founder is that he was able to recruit this top talent by promising them equity. So and that's a skill that I don't. So right now our team is much stronger than it was 1 year ago when I was flying solo. So
love that. And then where did you meet your co-founder?
He found me for my books. Yet another function.
Interesting. So, I mean, we're coming close on time, but we need to get that story in. Like, tell us how did he find you and how did he approach and like how did that relationship start?
Well, he found me he was a serial entrepreneur himself before this, and then he has a keen interest in finance, in tech, and in marrying finance and technology, fintech. Well, and then the kind of fin that he's talking about is asset management, particularly quantitative asset management. And so he looked for books that are written by well-known authors in this space. And of course, one of my books were the one that he read. And so he just co-emailed me or co-LinkedIn connect with me. And he pitched me his vision. And of course, I'm open to all proposals. So a lot of people propose me from student. I have high school students that email me and talk about how I'm trading. And I enjoy conversation with them. I have people from, you know, Goldman Sachs email me. So I'm open to all sort of approaches. And I, you know, obviously I take a skeptical approach in the beginning. But, you know, one thing I look for in any business associate is their persistence. And boy, if he's not a persistent guy. So he impressed me by his tenacity. So, and you know, it seems to me that he is a very strong kind of sales-driven CEO, which I'm not, to be honest. I waited, I'm just doing PR and waiting for inbound, but he really go out and make deals. So, yeah, so it has been, you know, very good and so far. And so now we are planning the merger formally. So that we can work together in a much more efficient way.
Love that. And then thanks again for coming on today. As a final question, where can people find you and your books online?
Well, if they Google Ernest Chan, they will find a book. Or yes, Chan is my last name. Just Google my name and you'll find all my books. Or go to Amazon. They can find my books if they Google my name. So very easy.
Perfect. And we will also make sure to link up your LinkedIn and link up the company below as always. Ernest, was a pleasure to talk.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I enjoyed it very much. Take care, Nicholas.
If you like this episode, then you'll love the SaaS Operator, a weekly newsletter brought to you by Earlynode with actionable insights from SaaS experts in the industry delivered right to your inbox every Tuesday for free. Visit earlynode.com to subscribe.